And this is Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. I don't know if you caught the debate last night, Avi. I did. It was fast-paced, innovative, interesting.
I have an infant, so there's no such thing as uninterrupted viewing right now, but I caught as much of it as I possibly could, and I did think it was a quality debate overall. The mayoral debate we are talking about in Philadelphia, by the way.
Absolutely, at Temple University. And in a few minutes, we're going to be talking with one of the candidates for mayor, Derek Green. He's here in the studio.
And then later in the hour, an alleged scheme worth $175 million, we are digging into Wharton grad Charlie Javis and her financial aid startup. Why this 30 under 30 star is now being charged with fraud and conspiracy.
Fascinating story for sure. And you can call 888-477-9499 or email studio2@whyy.org. That's like the number 2. We're also visiting the work later in the hour of sound sculpturist Harry Batoya later on today. But first, we're going to dig into the news roundup.
Got to do our news roundup. And we are starting with an active situation. Firefighters right now are working to contain a large wildfire in the Pinelands in South Jersey. So far has taken over 3,800 acres. It forced some people to evacuate temporarily. I believe at last notice those evacuation orders have been lifted. But the fire broke out last night in Manchester Township, about 50 miles east of where we are right now in Philadelphia. We don't know the cause yet, Cherry, but of course we're thinking about everybody in the impacted area.
Yeah, the good news is right now there have been no injuries. If you don't know about the Pinelands, they are made up of over 1 million acres of protected forest. So very important area.
And what's interesting is that the forest, in an ecological sense, relies on wildfires. Like that's why there are pines there. The pine species there are forged in these fires. And so there's always been this very careful sort of back and forth between maintaining and protecting the humans who live there and protecting the ecosystem. And so every time there's a fire in the Pinelands, I just think about that careful balance between, you know, nature and humanity.
And we had a risk, and the National Weather Service had issued a risk because of low humidity and the wind. So I want to move on over to the city of Chester. We all know that the city of Chester, they're having some financial troubles. They're basically broke. We know that. But what we may not know is that the bankrupt municipality, if it does not make fiscal changes and soon, they could cease to exist as a city. That is the absolute worst case scenario. It was laid out by Chester's receiver, Michael Dowry, on Tuesday during a public meeting. That pronouncement comes just as we near the third year anniversary of Governor Tom Wolf declaring a fiscal emergency in the city. The receiver says, you know, ceasing to exist is called disincorporation. It's something that is almost unheard of and is something that they want to avoid. And if it happened, though, all the city employees will be laid off. All the elected officials will be removed from office. And the Pennsylvania Department of Community and Economic Development would appoint an administrator. That would be a horrible, horrible outcome.
Yeah, no one wants this to happen. We should make that clear. You said unheard of. I'm not aware, and maybe a listener will correct me. I'm not aware of anything like this happening to even a mid-sized city in Pennsylvania. And we should point out that in 1950, Chester had 66,000 people. It's not a small town. It's been a city and a major city, an industrial hub for many generations. And there have been Pennsylvania cities in the past that have been like annexed, but those are more in growth scenarios, not in decline scenarios. So I've never heard of this even really being put on the table. And it's
kind of sad.
Sad.
Yeah. I want to point out that Chester's cash reserves, they're very low. And the receiver's team estimates that Chester will have an operating deficit in 2024 and have an insurmountable debt by 2025. And so solutions, they say, must be put in place by the end of this year. Kenny Cooper has more on this story. You can check out all of his reporting on this at WHYY.org.
And we will keep our eye on that, just as Kenny has now for many months and years. So now we're going to pivot to our newsmaker interview today. We have, here at Studio 2, invited all of the candidates running for mayor of Philadelphia to come into the studio for a conversation. We're going to be rolling those segments out over the next month between now and the May primary. First up in our series is Democratic candidate Derek Green. He is a former Philadelphia City Council member at large and a prosecutor. Derek Green, welcome to Studio 2.
Well, welcome. It's a pleasure to be here with both of you. And as your lead-in was talking about both, I'll say, conflicts and scandals. I thought you were continuing the conversation from last night.
I thought maybe
Jeff Cole left Fox 29 and joined WHYY. But hey, also the
wouldn't
issue,
be a bad hire.
Also the issue of Chester, which really pains me. And I'm a former president of Pennsylvania Municipal League, which is an organization that represents all of the cities and municipalities in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And the issues that are happening in Chester are very troubling. That is a border city to the city of Philadelphia. And, you know, the person, which I hope will be me, the next leader of the city of Philadelphia, yeah. You don't only lead the only city of the first class in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, but you're the leader of the region.
The hub of the region.
You're the hub of the region. And it's really concerning what's happening in Chester, as well as some of the comments that were made last night about Chester as well.
Right. You are referring, I believe, there to Jeff Brown's comments. We might get to that. But first, we want to talk about your top priority for a green administration. And I want it to be one top priority and what you would do about that priority in the first 100 days in office.
Well, the number one issue in our city is gun violence. I know you've been filing a lot of these candidate forums, and you've actually hosted a candidate forum, was a moderator. But every single forum, whether economic development, African-American community, affordable housing, tourism, education, despite the original topic, it all comes back to public safety. That's the number one issue. And for me, as a former assistant district attorney who was once racially profiled while leaving the DA's office, and when I think about last year, we had 2,200 shootings. 74% of the victims and shooters look just like me. So we have to really aggressively go after the gun violence that's going on in this city. I've had conversations with mothers who've lost loved ones and fathers who've lost loved ones. And it really pains me when I just think about what's happening in our city. And so we have to go about that in a very aggressive way. That's why I released a public safety plan based on my experience as an assistant district attorney. I was also a prosecutor in Delaware as well, and talked with a number of other former prosecutors, assistant U.S. attorneys, to put together a plan to really go after the gun violence in our city. Because we have to have more police officers, but also we have to have accountability. But we also have to provide opportunity and investment for young people who may have been caught up in the criminal justice system to give them a path out. We need to have a combination approach. It's not one or other. It's not either or, it's and.
And I didn't hear the answer to the question, which is, what would you do in the first 100 days to set this priority?
Well, I would start right after the May 16th primary. On May 17th, working on putting together my public safety plan in reference to how do we bring in police officers that reflect the city of Philadelphia, using my idea of a hiring bonus to do that, talking with other former police commissioners and how we start working on addressing the issues of how we recruit police officers into the city of Philadelphia, but also in reference to the issue of accountability, talking with our current U.S. Attorney Jacqueline Romero about how we can put together my plan of working with the Assistant U.S. Attorney's Office in a much more structured way. We currently have a gun violence task force, which has a memorandum of understanding between the DA's office and the Attorney General's office. My plan talks about doing something similar with the U.S. Attorney's Office. So I would start from the day after the primary, start working on those plans and also some of the other perspectives in reference to opportunity investment and how we address some of the issues in our city to get people jobs. Talk with organizations like JEBS that has The Choice Is Yours, and talk about how we can lay out focused deterrence in a citywide perspective, more than just the pilot we had in the Nutter administration.
And Derek, I want to ask you about motivation. I mean, if we were to rank the mayoral candidates, and I'm talking about tangible items like money raised, union endorsements, leadership and support, you're not in the top five. Okay. I got to ask you, what motivates you to stay in the race? And also, in your mind, what is the clear path to victory here?
Well, what motivated me to get in the race to begin with? And you talked about Chester. And I was the past president of Pennsylvania Municipal League. Before that, I was also the national president of Democratic Municipal Officials. And so seeing the challenges that are happening in the city of Philadelphia and seeing other cities being much more aggressive and going
after those
dollars.
Is that keeping you in the race?
And that's kept me in the race to this point. Also, you know, my son has motivated me to keep me in this race. When I think about the challenges he's gone through as someone on the autism spectrum and the things he's been able to achieve, that also motivates. But also the people in the city of Philadelphia have motivated me to stay in the race at this point. Because when I talk to residents and neighbors. When people see me on the street, they say, keep pushing, keep going forward. So I'm looking at this issue, looking at where I am right now, but also understand we have some issues in our city that I'm concerned about. And there's some issues that I want to continue to push forward and address, from the public safety issue, from the issues of reference to autism, affordable housing, economic development in the city of Philadelphia. When I talk about this city needs a Maynard moment, and we just saw the recent article showing the level of income for African Americans going down mm-hmm. in this city. Mm-hmm. We have some real issues to need to address, and these issues need to be addressed in a way that other candidates right now are not addressing.
You did have a recent quote, though, in the Inquirer that you think after this election there's going to be, quote, a high appetite for electoral reform, which sounded to me like someone who's a consensus compromise candidate saying, I'm not sure if I can compete with someone who has a smaller but very devoted base in this very fractured primary field. What did you mean by those comments? And is that, are you pessimistic about your chances here?
No, when I said a high appetite for electoral reform, that whoever's going to win this election, they're going to win with a plurality. And they're going to have to be able to govern in a way that's not having a mandate. We're seeing for the first time in this city someone that may win this race with possibly Absolutely. Less than 100,000 votes. That's never happened before. So when I'm talking, when I made that statement,
you think you could be that person, but you're saying that's still not a good outcome.
It's not a good outcome because you're going to have more people that voted not for you, but voted for someone else.
Sure.
That's when I talked about my issues regarding campaign finance reform, legislation I introduced in city council, because we definitely have too much money in this race. Issues regarding ranked choice voting, which I've had mm-hmm. hearings in city council regarding, but we need help at the state level. So these are issues that we need to talk about, continuing the work I've done regarding ethics reform and campaign finance reform that I've done as a staffer and also as a member of city council. So when I made that statement about all those issues at the same time.
I got to ask you, because you said that you would get rid of, you would have a new police commissioner, that you would bring in hiring bonuses for cops, and that you would also work with the U.S. Attorney's Office to get guns off the street. I want you to expound on how you plan to get guns off the street, which is a major problem in Philly.
Well, the problem of when I remember from my time being in DA's office, you used to have assistant U.S. attorneys in police districts. We don't have that type of relationship. And from my experience, if you're a young person that was unfortunately caught up in the criminal justice system, you didn't want to have a gun on you because you knew if you got arrested with a gun, you may get federal time. Right now, there's no certainty of punishment in reference to those that have guns. So people don't have a fear in reference to being arrested. I mean, I've talked to friends who are defense attorneys, and they have a perspective that some of their clients will say, listen, I'm not going to contact you until I see what happens with the district attorney's office. That's what's happening right now. So we have a situation in the city of Philadelphia like the Wild Wild West, where people are carrying guns, and then other people are saying, I'm carrying guns for my own protection. We shouldn't have a situation in the city of Philadelphia where people are either, I got to have a gun on me to protect myself because other people are shooting. That's not the environment that we should be having in this city. Definitely not have that environment in this nation as when we look at other developed nations that don't have the same issues of gun violence. And that doesn't even go into the issues of behavioral health and mental health that we've seen most recently, especially in Louisville, Kentucky.
So this is real quick. I know you've talked a lot about the city tax code. We have about 20 seconds. One big change you would make to the city tax code if you could make it right now.
Well, the one big change, I would continue to reduce the taxes we have for small businesses as a former small business owner. That's why I put together a plan to reduce taxes for small businesses, especially the net income portion of the business income receipt tax, because
okay.
that's an issue.
Yeah,
that's
we'll have to leave it okay. there. Thank you so much, Derek Green, for joining us.
Thank you so much. Always a pleasure.
Be that's fine. Derek Green, Democratic candidate for the next mayor of Philadelphia.
Coming up, we are talking about a Wharton graduate named Charlie Gevese, who is alleged to have scammed J.P. Morgan Chase. That story coming up on Studio 2.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
And you are tuned in to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. It has become a familiar story, Avi.
All too familiar.
A young, charismatic startup founder has this brilliant idea. They get a lot of hype in major publications. They get put on these cool lists and they rake in the dough. And then, drum roll, it turns out it was all an elaborate deception. Well, we may have a new version of that story, and it starts right here in Philly.
Charlie Javis went to Penn's famous Wharton Business School. She used that experience to found a startup called Frank. This company claimed to help millions of young people navigate the complex system of college financial aid, and it is a complex system. Javis was so successful with this idea, she sold the company to J.P. Morgan Chase in 2021 for $175 million, all before turning 30. But now the Department of Justice says it may have been a scam, and many of the supposed customers never existed.
And last week, the DOJ unsealed criminal charges against founder and CEO Charlie Javis for defrauding J.P. Morgan. The Securities and Exchange Commission also has a fraud complaint against her. Here to fill us in on this sordid tale is the New York Times Your Money columnist Ron Lieber. He's been writing about Charlie Javis and the alleged fraud. He's also the author of The Price You Pay for College. Call us with your questions about this story, what it says about startup culture, and about our unwieldy financial aid system. We want to hear from you. The number is 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2 at whyy.org, and that's 2 like the number.
Ron, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, a lot of setup there. We have been talking so much about this story in our offices right behind the studios. But we want to, before we get into the sprawling implications, we really have to establish a timeline here. So the protagonist of the story is this young woman named Charlie Javis. She's from outside New York City. She comes to Wharton at the University of Pennsylvania as an undergraduate beginning in the early 2010s. And part of the story that she tells, Ron, is that she herself had problems navigating the world of college finance. So what is the story she tells about her time at Penn and her arrival at Penn?
So the story she tells is that she was a recipient of need-based financial aid. And in order to get that financial aid, you've got to fill out this form called the FAFSA each year. And for those people who have ever experienced it or even looked at it, you know that it's really complicated. And the story she told is that she and her parents were just dumbfounded, not only by the form, but also by the process and the appeals they had to file to Penn to get more money. And this was in spite of the fact that her dad supposedly had a decades-long record of work on Wall Street, where he presumably was exposed to fairly sophisticated financial systems. And yet, she claimed that this was just a really tough go for her and her family.
But her dad presumably made a lot of money.
And, so, and both of her parents had master's degrees.
Right. So it's a little unclear to me. She's claiming she qualified for financial aid, right, Ron?
She is claiming that, and Penn would not and probably cannot legally confirm whether she actually received financial aid or whether that was just part of the story that she told that wasn't true. I tried to get both Charlie and her parents to comment on the circumstances under which she supposedly qualified for need-based aid, even though her dad supposedly worked on Wall Street for decades. And I could not get them to comment.
And so, Ron, I want to jump in here and just ask you to tell us, anchor us. This is the basis of her reason for starting this company, Frank. Tell us about the company and then sort of walk us through how it got to a point where she presented it for funding to J.P. Morgan.
Sure. So the way she told it in all sorts of interviews, including multiple podcasts that Penn itself promoted, is that this idea of hers, which was not her first or even her second startup, by the way, but this idea of hers was born of the experience and the frustration she had herself. And she thought, if I can create a bit of technology that helps people fill out this federal financial aid form, the FAFSA, faster, that would be a good thing to do in the world, and it would be a way to gather up potentially millions of customers and then maybe help them with other things too.
So 2016, right? She's only 24 years old, and she founds this company called Frank. And what you're describing is what Frank was supposed to do. Is that
exactly
right?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, that was what Frank was supposed to do, right? You would go to their website, and they would walk you through, kind of escort you through a piece of software that they had created. They would ask you for some financial information and would effectively help you fill out the FAFSA and avoid mistakes with maybe less sort of frustration and time than it might have.
And I believe we lost Ron there on the line. Is Ron still there?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I can continue to fill in some of the gaps in this story, and hopefully we can reconnect with Ron. One of the things that's interesting about this story, Cherry, is that even before she founded Frank, Ron, are you there? Did we have you back on the line? Yep, there he is. Ron, you with us? No, in and out, in and out.
Yeah.
So one of the things that's interesting is even before Charlie Gervais founded this company called Frank in 2016, when she arrived at Penn, when she was like 19 years old, she was already on these like lists. She was on a list, for instance, from the company called Fast Magazine, which is a legit publication, mm-hmm. by the way. She was on this list of the 100 most creative people because of some work she had done in microfinance in high school. Mm-hmm. And it's so interesting how quickly a hype bubble started to build around her ideas and just her personality. So even before she graduates Penn, this woman is starting to sort of like get coverage in mainstream media. And that's such a fascinating part of the story.
It mushrooms and it snowballs in a way, because once one person sort of gave her legitimacy, other people felt comfortable, or other publications felt comfortable to give her legitimacy. Ron Lieber is back. Ron, are you with us?
I hope so.
Yes. Okay, there you are, Ron.
There you are, Ron. And by the way, from the New York Times.
Ron is the Your Money columnist for the New York Times. We're talking about the story of Charlie Gervais, founder of Frank Financial, a company that is alleged to have swindled $175 million from J.P. Morgan.
So let's get back on the timeline of the story, Ron. She's building this company. She founds this company called Frank in 2016. Who does she initially interest in investing in? And do you have a sense of why those people invested?
Sure. Well, the reason you pay $350,000 for a Wharton undergraduate education, if you're paying full price and are not on financial aid, is in part to buy yourself a network. And so she goes out to people that she knows from her Wharton circles and from other circles that she's become involved in, and she presents a business plan and says, look, I think we can get millions of dollars into our system and help these people with financial aid. And then once they have an affinity for our brand, maybe there's a way we can make money off of them in the future, even if we give them the financial aid tool at the beginning for free.
So Ron is in and out. So we're going to get him back in about 45 seconds on a different line. But that's a really interesting point, Cherry, and something you want to circle back to later, is that
The network. And so when you're in a network of people who there's a level of trust that may exist for you, that would not exist if you were outside of the network.
Yeah.
So this will kind of tee up the next section of course, Ron telling us the story and how it led to this swindling.
Yeah.
Because
Alleged swindling.
Let's be clear, because everybody is considered innocent until proven guilty in a court of law. But at this point, the alleged swindling, part of the hook is that Charlie Gervais was connected in a way and got in rooms that ordinary people may not have gotten into because of her connection to Wharton School. And Ron, when you talk about her connection and the due diligence that was or was not paid to this, and how it ties to her being within this very Ivy League, very privileged, connected network.
Well, when you go hunting for venture capital investment, the venture capitalists, if they are at all interested in what you are offering, generally do some form of due diligence. And some venture capitalist firms do less and some do more. And I think it's fair to say that generally, if you come through a personal connection or if you're part of a community that you share with the venture capitalist, maybe they're less likely to dig really deep into the idea that you're sharing. And the other thing here is that we have to remember that, you know, venture capitalists, they're looking to get 3 or 4 investments out of any 100 investments really, really right, right? So it's like, if you fail 90% of the time, that's fine. Because if you've got 3 or 4 investments that end up being worth $1,000 or 1,000 times more than the money you put in, then you've done really well. And so, you know, they don't worry so much about the potential for failure as long as they succeed a couple of times out of every 100 investments.
So by the time she is presenting this business to JP Morgan Chase, she's already convinced a lot of people to invest in her, angel investors. And she also at that point is able to present JP Morgan with a business that supposedly is serving many, many people. What was she claiming about the business at the time in 2021 when JP Morgan decided to purchase it for $175 million. What were her main claims about the reach of the business?
She was claiming that she had something like 4 million active users. Now, the definition of users in this world can vary dramatically. Yeah. But in this particular instance, and you know, from the legal filings, it seemed like the way that the bank was defining users was you have you, Frank, the company, have, you know, 6 or 8 pieces of personal information about the users, and they engaged with the software to try to file or fill out a financial aid form in some way, shape, or form. That was the definition of users here, and that's what JP Morgan was interested in.
Why were they interested in those users? From a business perspective.
Sure. If you are a bank, there are only a couple of ways to get new customers. You can spend hundreds of dollars trying to, you know, acquire them through direct mail or internet ads. You can steal them away from other banks, or you can try and get new people coming into the market. And if there are new adults who have college degrees, and you've got a list of 4 million of them, and they have already engaged with another financial services company, namely Frank, and have good feelings about that company, you can use that company and that list of 4 million people to try to sell them new stuff when they're 22 or 24. And if you do it right, they'll be with you for 50 years and be really profitable customers. So they were buying a pipeline of new business, or so they thought.
And as a former financial aid recipient, I got to jump in here and just point out the fact that these are individuals who probably would have student loans, and they're dealing with some of the vulnerable college graduates, I would say. And so their goal in a lot of way was to sort of feed on this group. Is that fair?
That's fair. And, you know, what's so interesting about it, right? And, you know, I'm speaking from the perspective of a financial aid kid myself. Right. You know, you and I, Terry, we were the people who did not have money, who needed money. Yeah. Right. And it's sort of ironic that all these folks are trying to make money off the people who don't have enough, because if they had enough, they would not be applying for aid.
Yep.
And I had a follow up. When did J.P. Morgan figure out that they bought a pile of crap?
Because they bought the company in 2021. And at what point did they get wise to this thing?
Well, let's be careful here to insert the word allegedly.
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 Keep saying that.
Yep. Alleged power.
Right. Nothing has been proven. So what J.P. Morgan has said in their lawsuit, what the Department of Justice has said, is that J.P. Morgan did do at least some due diligence. And there was a lot of back and forth about the millions of people that were supposedly on this customer list, right? And Frank presented this list of millions of people, but it was only when J.P. Morgan did a test where they took their first shot at trying to sell new stuff to Frank's customers that it realized, because the response rate was abysmal, that something was very wrong with the list. And then they started doing even more investigation. But that was after the deal had closed. They didn't do the list before the deal closed.
So we are talking, if you're just joining us, with Ron Lieber, who is the Your Money columnist for the New York Times and has been following this strange saga of a Wharton graduate named Charlie Javis. So, okay, so J.P. Morgan gets a sense that maybe these users aren't exactly all real people, or at least not real Frank customers. Then, in the subsequent lawsuit, they, I think, map out what they think Javis did to trick them and basically to create these users who sort of didn't exist. So what is the allegation? What is Javis supposed to have done to create the illusion of users?
Yeah, well, you know, memo to startup founders everywhere. When someone acquires your company, they also acquire your email. And J.P. Morgan went back into Charlie Javis's email and those of her colleagues and realized that there was this flurry of activity around the merger and right after the closing to basically stuff the customer list with a whole bunch of names and emails that allegedly had been invented from whole cloth or purchased from outside direct mail companies, so that a list of 4 million people or 3 million people with names and emails and whatnot could be presented to J.P. Morgan Chase as a complete list of Frank customers. And the allegations were that, in fact, the real number of Frank customers was, you know, something like 8, 10, 12% of what they actually told Chase that they had, right? So they basically exaggerated tenfold what the number of customers that they actually had. That's wow. The allegation.
And so I have a question for you, Ron, because I'm surprised that J.P. Morgan, number one, got duped in such a big way.
Allegedly
duped in such a big way. And it's pretty embarrassing. So I want you to make the argument. I mean, if the point of venture capitalist or capitalism is to sort of like invest and only have a 2 out of 100 go, why not just bury this and say, oops, we lost big. Why file a lawsuit? Why come out about it when you have egg on your face this way?
Yeah, so we were kicking this around our newsroom this morning, as with your shop. We're still talking about this all the time. And the only thing I can think of, right, is that J.P. Morgan Chase wanted to put out word to anybody else attempting to raise money from the bank, do business with the bank, or sell something to the bank, that it was not going to bury such things. And enough of all of this fraudulent activity, that seems to have come in, you know, bunches in the last 5 years from startup founders with a 2 in front of their age, right? Mm-hmm. Enough. And J.P. Morgan decided that whatever reputational damage it would suffer by getting up in public and saying, we believe we have been conned by someone without very much business experience, would be worth it in order to deter any future shenanigans that might come its way. Or it might just be that Jamie Dimon, the CEO, was so angry that he wanted to put Charlie Javis in prison personally. And that may end up being what happened.
So we have an email from Loretta who says, I got financial aid for Wharton and they walk you through the process so well. There's no way it would be so difficult for Charlie. That part of the story should have been a red flag in the beginning. And I want to use that as a launching point for a question, Ron, which is, you sort of say a little bit in your reporting that the people making these investments, even though they work in high finance, don't seem to really understand how college financial aid works. That is shocking to me. Can you explain that a bit for me?
Yeah, so here's what we do not know. We do not know whether the deal team, the due diligence team inside of J.P. Morgan Chase, actually had anybody on it who got financial aid, who had ever filled out a financial aid form. And if all of the bankers there were pretty far removed from not having enough money themselves, whether they thought to bring somebody in during the due diligence process who knew the first thing or the fifth thing or the tenth thing about how the system works. We don't know that, right? But afterwards, a number of financial aid experts, you know, as I explained in my longer story about Javis, were like, hey, you know, the numbers here don't add up on the most basic of levels mm-hmm. in terms of the claim she was making about the number of customers she had. And they were essentially saying, had anybody bothered to Google financial aid expert and called me, I could have fixed all of this, you know, for them and explained to them what the problem was in approximately 172 seconds.
Wow.
And I got to slide a question in here, Ron, because I'm thinking about folks like Sam Bankman-Fried, folks like Elizabeth Holmes, mm-hmm. who is set to begin an 11-year prison sentence later this month. And I'm thinking about the demographics of Charlie Javis, white woman, you know, connected with a brilliant idea. Talk about the culture of this as we get close to wrapping up and just how this she had doors opened and available to her that a lot of folks wouldn't have available to them and didn't even have to go through heavy due diligence to get that kind of money.
About 30 seconds, Ron.
Yeah, look, I mean, there will always be liars and cheaters in the world of business and in the world of capitalism. There are just too many gains to be gained. And it is true that if you have privilege and access, you're more likely to have the doors open to you. I don't doubt that. Whether we should blame this on youth or whether we should blame this on capitalism or on venture capitalists or bankers who don't do enough diligence, I think there's a lot of blame to go around here. And it'll happen again. It always seems to.
So that is Ron Lieber. He is the Your Money columnist for the New York Times. Ron, thanks so much for joining us.
Coming up, that's music created by Pennsylvania artists. We'll have more coming up.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg.
All right, Cherry, I got a story for you about a magical music barn in Upper Bucks County. Got to ask, are you intrigued?
Well, anytime you talk about magic, I'm intrigued.
So I got turned on to this music barn after reading a piece recently in the New York Times by a freelance journalist. Apparently it's New York Times Day, by the way. Mm-hmm. Freelance journalist named Grayson Haver-Curran. And the story is all about the artistic legacy of a guy named Harry Bertoia.
So what got you so interested in Harry Bertoia?
So Harry was a sculptor. And in this barn that I talked about, he made a very specific type of sculpture. These were sound sculptures. And recently, there's been more and more interest in his work. But just as interesting, there's a problem, which is that his children are in the middle of a major dispute about how this work should be preserved.
Sounds like a show that I love on HBO called Secession.
With the art version.
Yeah.
Exactly. So anyways, I wanted to dive into the fascinating story of Harry Bertoia. So earlier this week, I called up Grayson Haver-Curran, the journalist I spoke about earlier, and he told me about how Harry Bertoia began making these unusual sculptures. It all started in the 60s when he was working in Upper Bucks County as a furniture designer, making chairs and working with pieces of wire.
Two pieces of wire, I believe as he was making one of these chairs, hit each other. And he thought, well, you know, that's a fascinating sound. You know, if it started with two pieces of wire, it ended with hundreds of pieces of wire. It creates this symphony. It creates this beautiful mass of sound. And it's so physical, and it's so beautiful, and it feels like a choir singing. It feels like, you know, being inside of a really loud heavy metal concert. It's all those things at once.
So this guy is a furniture designer living in eastern Pennsylvania in a sort of wooded area, right? A little off the beaten path, right?
That's right. Yep, Bally, Pennsylvania, which I think is, you know, which is not that far from Allentown. So he started recording these sculptures with microphones in his barn, this old, centuries-old stone barn. It wasn't like the big thing that he did. It wasn't the thing that people knew him for.
They knew him for the visual art. They didn't know him for the recordings of the sculptures.
That's right. They didn't know that, like, he was this, like, secret musical alchemist in his barn in Pennsylvania, and that, like, he was making really deliberate, distinct recordings of these sculptures. So the barn is filled with these sculptures, right? He would work in there. He would practice in there. He would treat these like what they were, which is instruments, and he would play them, and he would develop these techniques for making these instruments, these sculptures, make this beautiful symphony. And then, like, you know, if he played them multiple sculptures at the same time, this barn would just turn into like a gigantic resonating chamber, and the thing vibrates.
People knew him for the visual work. They didn't really know him for these recordings for a long, long time. When and how did that change?
In Massachusetts, there's a record label called Important Records. John Bryan, who runs that record label, finally heard this music about 12 years ago. And so he hears this sound, he finds out there's more, he reaches out to the family. John Bryan puts it out, it starts to gain more notice. And then in 2021, the CD box set that Important Records had put out is reissued by Third Man Records. Third Man Records is owned by Jack White, famous rock star guy. It sells out instantly. They repress it. So, like, Bertoia started to catch a wave, you know, right? Like, here's this guy who at this point has been dead for almost 50 years. And whose music is finally being given the treatment it's long deserved, finally finding a new audience. I think the really important thing to say about Bertoia's music and these sculptures is they're so physical. And as so much of our life moves online, it goes, you know, so many of our experiences go digital. Being in the presence of these sculptures and the sounds they make is this really physical and increasingly rare experience where it's like a cold water plunge or something, right? Like, when you're inside of these sculptures, there is no other thought you can have. You're just there.
I need you to take me to this barn where all of this music was made and recorded. What does it look like as you wind through it?
Sure. So I visited the barn in late 2021. And, you know, I remember it was a snowy day in eastern Pennsylvania. And, you know, you sort of there, the edge of the Rust Belt, and, you know, passing these old, you know, it's factories and fields and forests on repeat. And then you show up down this very quiet street, and it's just this beautiful stone and wood barn. And you walk in and, you know, it's this two-storied, enormous, triangular barn filled with these sculptures. So, like, they're just wires standing at attention everywhere. And, you know, maybe with the breeze in the room, they're kind of very gently swaying. It feels like you're going to a concert in Stonehenge or something. Like, these stones and, you know, the ground is just shaking beneath you. And it feels like you're being rearranged on a cellular level or something.
Do you understand physically how this music was made?
Yeah, absolutely. So he moves through the barn, and he's tapping, strumming, hitting these rods. And the metal is hitting metal. It's making these sounds. And it's simply, you know, the microphones are capturing that sound and feeding it to the tape machine, but he was composing. Like, he was improvising. Of course, there's, like, a huge element of improvising, but he was hearing within these sounds textures and layers and, like, how different frequencies and overtones could fit together.
The music is ethereal, and it feels like it almost belongs to a different planet. More recently, this has gotten very earthbound with this family dispute. So describe as best you can what vision Harry's son Val has for the work and what vision Harry's daughter Celia has for the work.
Val wants people to come to the barn, you know, actually show up on his family property and he can show them the barn. Celia wants to spread these sculptures however she needs to in order for more people to experience them in whatever context they experience them. There's a lawsuit, and basically they divide the sculptures, and Celia has sold, Celia and the other daughter, Lesta, have sold most of their sculptures at Sotheby's about 2 years ago for about $6 million. And for Val, that is like, you know, the ultimate insult. He treats these sculptures as like a single instrument within this barn. They're fascinating people with different and fascinating visions for this work.
Beautiful sounds, dissonant family situation.
That's well put. Yes, great description.
Grayson Curran is a freelance journalist. He wrote a story recently for the New York Times about the local artist Harry Bertoia.
Very cool. Very cool.
So ominous sounding.
For sure. That is it for Studio 2 today. For more of our show, you can head on over to WHYY.org/Studio 2. And you can follow WHYY on Twitter. And we use the hashtag Studio 2.
Our producers are Debbie Builder and Paige Marie Bessler. Our engineer is Diana Martinez from Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia. She's Cherry Gregg. And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.